One that really got to me and to a lot of people was after the genocide in Rwanda, there was a sort of massive refugee sort of flood across to Congo, to Goma. And then there was a huge cholera epidemic and thousands of people dying every day. And I sort of went out to cover that and, you know, just apocalyptic images of just bodies being bulldozed into pits and stuff. I then went back about 4 months later, after the epidemic, and they built a playground for the kids and stuff, and you know, they were just kids there, refugees, just playing on a playground. And that was just so difficult to deal with. It was a lovely scene, I was sort of filming it, but it's the sort of one time I really broke down, just because when you've seen bodies being bulldozed into a pit, it's just so outside of your sort of ability to humanize it, to contextualize it. It's an amazing news image. You know, I mean, when you're doing that, your senses are heightened. You're making sure you get all the shots because you know this is a big news story. This is incredible. This is one of those sort of apocalyptic moments. When you go back and see kids playing in a playground, that's not a news image, but it just suddenly, it's kids playing in a playground, and it was kids 4 months before who had been bulldozed into pits. So that was, however trite that sort of sounds, that I think that probably had the biggest effect.
How did you cope with that at the time?
Well, I didn't really. I mean, I sort of. It's only really when I got home and I was editing. And it's the only time in my life I had a panic attack. I actually ended up in hospital with a panic attack. I suddenly couldn't breathe. And then was fine. But, you know, it was that moment. It was sort of that sort of what triggered it, really. So, so I didn't really cope very well, actually.
The first time you ended up in a conflict, what was going through your head there? Where you've got a camera and suddenly it all kicks off and you're in this foreign country?
Initially, it's fear, but then there's it's a cliche, but the adrenaline rush you get when you survive something, especially when you're sort of up that close to a conflict, and you sort of survive it, and you get the footage, it's just fantastic. It's it's a glorious feeling. So you get I think it's what's quite addictive as well is that glorious feeling, because it's like nothing else. So you're there right in the middle of a very dangerous situation, and you're filming it. I think also what you learn quite quickly, you feel much safer when you're looking through a lens than you do when you put the camera down. Because when you put the camera down, you're suddenly in the middle of a situation that you have no sort of control over. But when you're behind it, you're doing something, you're framing shots.
Does that apply to the reporter as well? So, you know, do you feel that the reporters maybe feel more exposed than the cameraman who's with them?
I think so. I mean, in if you're looking at it logically, the cameraman is more exposed because they need to get the shots. I mean, I think the most dangerous of all is photographers, because they're really exposed. All they need to do is get the image. You know, and often they're on their own. They're not with the reporter who's sort of pulling them back necessarily and saying, look, we need the context of this as well. So, you know, but the people who need to get the images are the most exposed. But you get a sense of, quite often, an ill-informed sense of security just for the act of looking through a viewfinder. You're suddenly seeing it as it goes out on telly almost. You're seeing the image, and your mind immediately is thinking wide shot, close-up, exposure, focus, all of those moments. You start thinking about a camera move, even though what's going on is quite dangerous. Whereas if you're a reporter and you're not sort of, you know, hiding behind a camera, you are acutely aware of the dangers, and you sort of take action accordingly.
What's your closest shave whilst you were out in Africa or just ex-Soviet Union?
There's sort of a couple of sort of firefights I've been in where there are sort of bullets going around, and a couple of times where you sort of get taken and, you know, you're told you're going to be killed and stuff, and then they don't. So, I mean, once I kind of thought it wouldn't happen, but there was another time I genuinely thought this was it. Yes, it was not a great moment, but then the euphoria afterwards when they don't actually kill you is second to none. So, I don't know whether it's worth going through that pain. for the sort of euphoric gain, I'm not really sure. But I mean, you know, it happened, and I went back, so I guess it sort of wasn't totally.
Was that a hostage situation?
Yes. Certainly at the time, I was young, I was single. It was all incredible adventure and exciting, and all of those elements. I think now, having a family and things, I think if I, you know, I just don't have that spirit of adventure, or, you know, suddenly there's that responsibility. You die when you're young, you die, obviously your parents are going to be upset and things, but if you're more than upset, but there's somehow when you have children yourself and you think, oh my god, if I were to go and sort of get killed in that situation, I think it does sort of make you think twice.
And do you think that there's maybe a shelf life for it, in terms of a lot of people that may go out there purely for humanitarian reasons, they want to show the world what's going on, they'll get sucked into that kind of adrenaline kick. Is it kind of hard to come off that?
Oh, it's incredibly hard. It's because it's like no other feeling in the world, when that adrenaline being in a firefight. But you do, it's really how you stop yourself becoming jaded, or knowing, either being able to look beyond that and really get sort of stuck into a story or a region, or just to be honest with yourself and thinking this is getting so far removed from the reasons you sort of wanted to go in the first place. For me, it was going to Somalia once, and because once you get known as sort of covering wars and famines, then the aid agencies start contacting you and saying, look, this is the next big place. And it's in their interest to do that, because they need the world to see their people interviewed, they need the world to see their projects in these places. Understandably, they need donations, and if people see a sort of humanitarian catastrophe and they see someone from Oxfam or Medicine Sans Frontières there, they're obviously more likely to give more money. So I totally get it from their point of view, but you have this slightly uneasy alliance where they end up sort of selling you a famine. So they say, oh, this is, you know, look, it's as bad as Rwanda. Oh, this is the next Somalia. So you then sell that story to your news editor and say, look, you know, I've got to go here, it's the next Somalia. And so you go, and when you go, they'll sort of say, oh, it's 100 people dying a day. You sort of need to quantify the death figures, so everyone has a context, because bodies do sell, and a famine, if you are about to cover a famine, or any news editor is going to put a famine on television, on the news bulletin, there needs to be a death rate. Bodies sort of become the currency, which is then used by aid agencies. They give you a number so you can contextualise it and decide if it's a big enough story. So when you then arrive, and I do remember arriving, and sort of, it's that sort of uneasy and unspoken moment of, where are the bodies? And I remember sort of going to sort of see the feeding camps, the emergency feeding camps, and you know, I think there's a couple of people who died there that day, but it was not a big death toll at all, and certainly not what I'd been promised. Your first feeling is disappointment that you've come all this way and it's not the news story you were expecting or sold. And it's that moment where you really sort of have to step outside of yourself and think, I'm now disappointed that not more people are dying. You are there to make a story and to sell the story and things. So for all those reasons, it's annoying. But obviously there is a far bigger reason that shouldn't be annoying. But it's still more annoying than it's not. And I think that's the point where I just thought, you know, you just chase bodies after a while. You chase bodies, and you chase the adrenaline of being in a firefight. And it stops being about anything else but that. And a lot of, I think, photographers are the most exposed to that, because they just have to get an image. They don't necessarily need the context of the conflict. They're just there for the image, which makes you even more exposed. As you just go in, you have to push yourself to get that moment of drama. And it's why it is relatively easy to get yourself killed. Reporters like myself absolutely should never feel sympathy for, because you make a choice and you go. And you're going for adventure, and it's incredibly exciting. But any good that may ever come out of it is a byproduct of that sort of spirit and search for adventure. The journalists I absolutely feel sorry for, and we all should, are the ones based in countries, based in a regime where they are targeted, because the job they do is just unbelievably and unspeakably brave. To speak out against a regime which puts you directly in the firing line and makes you a target is just something I could never imagine doing. I'd go in, I'd fly in, you know, straight into the middle of a war zone or a famine or whatever it is, and it, you know, visually extraordinary and emotionally, you know, impactful and all of that, but then I go home. But there, you're not just you are there, your family's there. And that's that in terms of bravery that goes on today, it is one of the most bravest and noble professions I could ever imagine.